Audiobook made of the online version on the homepage of Martinus Institute, Copenhagen. The Fate of Mankind, Martinus. Translated by Mary McGovern, 86. First published in Danish in the magazine OM in 1933. Chapter 1. The Present Crisis of Mankind. As the fate of mankind at the present time takes the shape of a world crisis that, in the form of unemployment, poverty, ill health, revolution, killing of fetuses, murder, suicide, vices, perversities, unhappy marriages, irreligiousness and mental illness, is felt as a burden of such increasing magnitude that no individual human being can, in the long run, be untouched by it. An absolute overview of what is actually happening will not only be of immediate importance but will in fact be an absolute necessity if there is to be any talk at all of bringing this crisis to an end. Does not mankind then have such an overview? It does have science after all. It has wonderful universities, colleges and schools for the development of intelligence. It has laboratories for analyzing substances. It has observatories for the study of the position of the Earth in space. Indeed, this is very true. Nevertheless, it is, generally speaking, absolutely ignorant about what it is witnessing. For if it really had the correct overview, then it must, to judge from its behavior, without doubt be classified as abnormal or mentally ill. It owns immeasurable wealth, but lives in poverty. It has inexhaustible sources of nourishment, but is starving. It has at its disposal extraordinary conditions for the development of heating, but is cold. It has the most wonderful prerequisites for health, but suffers from an untold number of illnesses. It is in possession of immeasurable horsepower or means to make the elements work for it, but still eats its bread in the sweat of its brow. It has governments, ministers, presidents, kings and dictators, but lives in chaos and darkness. It has churches, temples, prophets and world redeemers through which and through whom the great commandment love one another or all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword has been preached as the road to life for thousands of years, but it nonetheless represents great ingenuity in the production of munitions and instruments of murder. So, if mankind possesses an absolute overview of its own power, then a psychoanalysis of it will show that it is completely abnormal. But fortunately this is not the case. Mankind is completely normal. It experiences things and uses the experiences. It invents and discovers things. It acquires knowledge and, through this, acquires power. It finds itself in a steadily upward evolution. It has far greater power and possesses far greater creative abilities than it did only 100 years ago. But if it has nevertheless not been able to subdue the earth, this is because it does not yet have enough experience, and therefore also does not have the control over itself that is necessary for it to be able to avoid the disharmonies in which it lives. Chapter 2. The old must fall. The whole of mankind's state of misery is thus a question of evolution. No one can therefore be blamed for it, neither the priest nor the criminal, neither the rich nor the poor. It is based on the existing system. And one cannot demand that this should express a higher idealism or standard of evolution than that which the average human consciousness has reached and of which it constitutes a result. But as mankind is thus not abnormal but has the ability to experience things and to do research, it will, precisely through all those disharmonies and unpleasantnesses under which it now sighs and groans, arrive at an understanding of the most profound causes of these realities and thereby overcome its present dark fate. This fate, in all its details, will thus constitute the research object through which mankind today is obtaining knowledge about how a social system or a social administration should not be. Before its very eyes, experiences are unfolding today that elicit a growing antipathy towards existing circumstances and give rise to an undermining of the old social system. And this antipathy constitutes the first signs of the dawning of an incipient new age. It will soon be a fact for all that we are witnessing the downfall of the old world culture and the birth of a new world culture. We are passing an exceptionally important turning point in the history of Earth. We are beholding a milestone in the vast kingdom of eternity. The present generations of mankind have inherited great wisdom from the past. In order not to be too dazzling and impossible to comprehend, this wisdom was, by means of symbols and parables, adapted to suit the primitive imagination of previous generations. And since it is still being handed down couched in the same adaptations or parables, it does not have a strong enough effect on modern generations. These generations have come into possession of knowledge by other means, partly by scientific research and partly by the development of a greater emotional life, which, even if it is not enough to support the demands of religion and morality, has nevertheless long since eclipsed the outer clothing or interpretation by which the inherited wisdom was dimmed. This interpretation has therefore been viewed by modern generations more and more as antiquated and naive, and has become more and more dogmatic. This must then in turn give rise to disharmony between these generations and the preachers of traditional wisdom. Rethinkers arose, interest in going to church declined, it became unfashionable to be religious, and a certain demoralization thus became possible. This disharmony has then in turn very often been described as irreligiousness. But this description is very mistaken, for no human being can, in the absolute sense, be irreligious. Even if he cannot believe in a particular parable, a particular form or dogma, he nevertheless believes in a truth. He demands only that it be shown in a form that resonates with his own innermost being. When it is interpreted in harmony with his own experiences, he believes without doubt. If he, in such a case, does not believe, it can only be because of pathological elements present in his consciousness. And he must then, as an abnormal being, be left out of consideration here. It is thus not only the material side of the experience of life but also the religious or spiritual side with which terrestrial human beings find themselves in disharmony. Chapter 3: The human being demands proofs. In order for perfect harmony to be born on earth, the eternal wisdom or the absolute truth about life must be revealed in such a way that it is in harmony with the absolute facts that the beings, through the development of their intelligence and feelings, have come to possess. It can no longer be shown as a dogma, a parable or a beautiful fairy tale without any real roots in daily experience and so merely as a matter of belief. It has to be shown as a reality scientifically rooted in real events. The irreligiousness of modern generations is thus in reality only a kind of religiousness that demands not only eternal wisdom as the absolute solution of existence but also the method of calculating this solution so that they themselves can check the calculation and make the same solution their own knowledge. It is this form of religiousness that we witness in what we call modern science. All scientists are thus in the absolute sense seekers after truth. Through all kinds of schools and educational centers, the above-mentioned form of religiousness is spreading among ordinary people. Every human being who has learned to count or who can work out the solution of 2 plus 2 is thus an incipient scientist, an incipient worshipper of wisdom, even if it is not usual to view him in this way. And it is a matter of course that the more such a form of religiousness develops, the more a religiousness based on blind belief must decline. The basis for this new development of religiousness is in turn to be found in the accelerated development in the last century of the individual's faculty to analyze, which we call intelligence. Intelligence is in turn the first sense through which the individual can come to the absolute knowledge or analysis of his experiences. As people here on earth to the greatest extent are subject to material or physical experiences, it is these which for the time being constitute the dominating object for the searchlight of intelligence. And the first absolute knowledge mankind thereby comes to possess must therefore to a corresponding degree of necessity be of a materialistic or physical nature. When modern science is expressed as physical or material, this is only a manifestation of the fact that its advocates or originators still do not have very many spiritual experiences towards which they can direct their intelligence. They are therefore to a corresponding degree excluded from acquiring spiritual knowledge, regardless of how great their intelligence may be. Just as physical experiences are needed in order to give physical knowledge, so spiritual experiences are needed to give spiritual knowledge. Modern science is therefore not yet an authority on spiritual and occult matters. But what it is not today, it will become in the future. the culmination of physical knowledge. Having been passed, the culmination of the hunger for spiritual knowledge will arise. Chapter 4, Spiritual Knowledge. What then is spiritual knowledge? Spiritual knowledge consists of analyses of experiences that are promoted by forces that cannot be sensed by the ordinary physical senses. What sort of forces are these? We here find ourselves at the focal point of the whole religious problem. For the question is identical with the great question that is as yet unanswered for present-day mankind: what is truth? Can anything at all be said at the present moment about these forces? No, not through modern science. It is, as previously mentioned, still only at the frontier. But that does not exclude the possibility that accounts of the presence of the above-mentioned forces can nevertheless reach mankind. The point is that all human beings are not at the same level in evolution. Just as there are beings who are behind modern science in evolution, so there are also beings who are ahead of it and have already accumulated, or are now in the process of accumulating, experiences that are based on spiritual forces. They thereby come to possess layers of consciousness that are as yet unexperienced by science as well as by the rest of mankind. And the further ahead of the average consciousness of mankind these new layers of consciousness are, the more alien and fantastic they will appear to this mankind. The originators of these new layers of consciousness are termed occultists. If an occultist is so outstandingly developed that he senses just as well in the spiritual area as in the physical, then he can be a great benefactor and guide for his fellow beings. For he will then constitute a being who can give individuals not only the great solution of life but also the method of calculating it in such a way that they, by virtue of this, can gradually develop in themselves the ability to check the calculation, and thereby turn it into their own knowledge. The most outstanding of such occult beings are known by the terms messiahs or world redeemers. As ordinary people at an earlier point in time had a very elementary intelligence or faculty for analyzing, they did not demand to know the method of calculating the solution of life, but were satisfied with the solution itself, in which they believed blindly. Previous world redeemers had therefore the sole purpose of giving this solution in a form that would appeal to the faculty of these people, not to understand, but to believe. Their words were therefore law for the beings concerned. And it is repercussions of this that have turned the religious narratives into dogmas. A world redeemer in our time must, however, give not only the solution of life in an undisguised form, but must also show a method of calculation through which individuals, as their intelligence and feeling gradually become sufficiently developed, can check the solution and acquire it as their own experience. Such a method of calculation should here be understood simply as a logical, coherent chain of thought through which the highest solution of life can be acquired not as belief, but as knowledge. Chapter 5, World Redemption. What then is this great solution? It is so simple and straightforward that it has already been expressed through millennia in the form of the divine words "everything is very good." But as this analysis cannot be accepted by modern generations except in the form of science, it will therefore be the calculation of this solution, in intelligent coherent chains of thought, that will be the central feature in a new creation of fate, elevation of culture or world redemption for mankind. But as such a logical, coherent chain of thought cannot come into existence except in the form of a revelation of the eternal laws of life, the immortality of living beings, the identity of the universe as a living being, as a true Godhead, and in the form of a revelation of the great commandment "love one another" as the source of the harmony of life, then the desire for scientific analysis of these problems will thus in reality constitute the religiousness that the great hosts from science and irreligiousness and of free thinkers today unconsciously represent. As regards modern science, it is still far from being able to give scientific support to the great solution "everything is very good." Its area of research is still far too limited or local to allow the whole world plan to be viewed through it. Within this area nothing will therefore in reality be absolutely complete but, on the contrary, will constitute only local areas or links in the great, all-embracing plan on which the structure of the entire universe and the ability of living beings to experience life are based. But, since science cannot yet see beyond this limit and cannot therefore see the world plan, neither can it see the details within its own area of research as links in this plan, but must regard these as independent, as complete in themselves. But to judge unfinished things as finished must without doubt give rise to a false conception. As a false conception constitutes the opposite of reality, science will at its present stage of necessity argue that everything is not very good. As this reasoning is in opposition to the absolute fact or the eternal truth, which can only be expressed through the divine words "everything is very good," the life of mankind today is thus to a great extent based on an illusion. It believes itself capable of judging and analyzing everything within its present area of perception, while the reality is that on the continents of the earth there is absolutely nothing that is what it seems to be to the physical senses. But to live in an illusion must of course lead to the opposite of the meaning of life, which means to suffering instead of to bliss. And we have here arrived at the basic cause of the state of suffering or dark fate of terrestrial mankind. Can mankind then come to see the world plan and be brought to act in accordance with it and thereby come into harmony with life? Yes, it is, in the absolute sense, on the way to doing so. The religiousness that demands the solution of life supported by a logical, coherent chain of thought acceptable to developed intelligence and feeling has already led science, and thereby mankind, to the limits of the physical world. Chapter 6, Two Forms of Religiousness. As has been shown in the previous chapter, mankind can be divided into two forms of religiousness. Of these, one constitutes the generally known form that includes beings who can believe blindly in the religious accounts that have been handed down from the past without understanding them in the absolute sense. This means beings who live by dogmas and express themselves as believers, saved, holy or blessed, and who feel happy in their belief. The other form of religiousness includes all those individuals who cannot believe. Belief is not an act of will. One can have a sympathetic or an unsympathetic attitude towards an assertion, since such an attitude is subject to the control of the will, but to believe in an assertion is totally beyond the scope of the will. Either one has the faculty to believe or one has not. But as the faculty to believe is thus due to an innate faculty, then it is no crime to be irreligious, since one cannot carry out actions that are based on abilities one does not have. To the occult sight, all forms of intolerance therefore appear to be expressions of the highest degrees of naivety. One is equally naive if one mistakenly brands non-believers as infidels, as lost, as the children of the devil and so on. And it becomes even worse when one characterizes this vast host of beings as irreligious, because one then goes against the absolute facts. The experience of life is exclusively based on an attraction towards the unknown, which in turn constitutes the essence of every form of religiousness. Every normal human being has therefore a more or less strong desire for an explanation of the mystery of life. He is thus, on the basis of even the very minutest degree of curiosity or desire for knowledge, religious by nature. But all individuals are not equally critically minded as regards the interpretation of the mystery of life. And we here come to differentiate between beings who are satisfied with an emotional interpretation and beings who are not satisfied with this but must also have an intellectual interpretation. By an emotional interpretation should be understood a religious account or an expression of the highest mystery of life that can appeal more to the feelings of the individual than to his sense of logic. Such an interpretation is then manifested in the form of a ceremony or church service with accompanying organ music, hymn singing, altar candles, images of saints, baptismal ceremonies, sacraments, priests and altar boys in ceremonial vestments, beautiful accounts of loving deeds and so on. And it can of course not be denied that such an interpretation can be exceptionally inspiring, uplifting and ecstatic for the sensitive mind and give the individual a certain feeling of the presence of God. But this feeling is not perfect. It is a feeling without analysis. It is the blind man's impression of something that he cannot see. And so we have here the essence of the ordinary form of religiousness. Chapter 7, When One Becomes One with Life. By an intellectual interpretation of the mystery of life must, however, be understood an interpretation that plays on analyses of the individual's own experiences and facts in the area of feelings as well as in the area of reason. Such a form of interpretation can of course seem cold. But this is so only at the initial stage, when the individual is still concerned only with analyses of primitive material or physical phenomena. Gradually, as his faculty for intelligence develops more and more, so that he reaches the stage of being master over the analyses of the great, eternal realities upon which the entire universe and the hierarchy of all individuals in existence is based, he begins to experience the presence of God through the intellectual interpretation too. But then he is not a blind person who is feeling something he cannot see. Then he is a being beholding the eternal facts in the clear daylight of life itself as conscious facts. He then constitutes a son of God who, in the experiences of the great analyzers, thinks in the same way as the Almighty Father and has become one with the way, the truth and the life. All human beings on earth are thus absolutely without exception aspirants to this high stage in evolution. They are all heading towards this goal, both the religious and the so-called irreligious. In order to reach the above-mentioned stage, intellectual religiousness must ultimately be passed. Only then can the world plan be revealed fully illuminated for the individual. Chapter 8, Science is an Unborn Embryo. The irreligious should be referred to as the intellectually religious who demand knowledge instead of belief. They are driven forward by a steadily increasing desire to know. And intellectual religiousness becomes therefore born by a growing desire to analyze life and existence. The best known result of this is, as previously mentioned, science. As this in turn in the absolute sense cannot be science without being an expression of the analysis of a fact, it thus becomes the beginning of life's own absolute answer to the eternal facts, the beginning of an unveiling of the solution of life or the fact that everything is very good, but this beginning is very weak. Indeed, it is so weak that science on its path of evolution can still be regarded merely as an unborn embryo. But on the other hand, it is the embryo of something infinitely great and elevated. It constitutes the first weak beginning of nothing less than the divine reality that we express by the term the Holy Spirit. What then is the Holy Spirit? As spirit is the same as consciousness, and consciousness is in turn the same as the sensing or experience of life, the Holy Spirit thus becomes the same as the holy experience of life. As holy describes the opposite of imperfection, falsehood, impurity and the like, the holy experience of life will in turn be the same as the unadulterated, pure experience of life. And as the highest expression for such an experience can only be expressed through the divine words "everything is very good," the Holy Spirit is the same as the experiencing of life from the highest viewpoint of existence and thereby in contact with the Eternal Father. It cannot be denied that terrestrial science, seen in the perspective of these analyzers, is still at the embryo stage of what it will one day become, namely the promised spokesman, the Holy Spirit, without which the absolute analysis of life can never become a fact for the individuals. That it has not become usual to regard terrestrial science in this way or as an expression for religiousness is due to the fact that it is still primarily based only on the analyzing of material experiences. But do other experiences exist? No, in reality not. In order, however, to help the reader to the answer to this question, I regret I must appeal to the patience of the reader, for I am here obliged to move into areas that are primarily visible only to clear cosmic sight and must therefore be regarded as not experienced by the great majority of mankind. The subject matter therefore presents a greater challenge to the intelligence of the reader than the subject matter of easier, generally known areas. But I cannot of course give a true picture of such a great subject as the fate of mankind if I can move only within areas that can be accepted by a primitive intelligence. Confident that I will benefit my readers more by making my book a work field or training field for their spiritual abilities than by turning the subject matter into light, sentimental entertainment, I have chosen the former path and shall here try to give a brief outline of the relation of mankind, and therefore of science, to the entire substance of the universe and the planes of existence, and in the next chapter deal with science and the limits of the physical world. Chapter 9, the physical world and the spiritual world. As any form of experience whatsoever is identical with the reaction to an interaction between two forms of energy, namely the concerned being's own energy and the energy of the being's surroundings, and as energy in turn, in the absolute sense, is the same as substance or matter, all existing experiences will in reality be based on matter and are thus material. That it is not usual to perceive it in this way is due to the fact that matter appears in degrees of different density and with different characteristics. As the senses of the terrestrial human being are primarily built to react only through the interchange between the most dense degrees, then the other more rarefied degrees of energy become more and more gaseous until they eventually become totally invisible, in ratio to the distance they reach beyond the terrestrial human being's area of sensory perception. But this, of course, does not alter the fact that these degrees of energy do exist. And in daily life one therefore differentiates between visible and invisible energies. One calls the condensed energies physical matter and the gaseous energies spirit, just as the area of the former energies is expressed as the physical world and the area of the latter is perceived as the spiritual world. This latter world is thus also material, even though it is made up of refined energies or matter. The total substance or energy of the universe appears to the occult sight in seven different basic sorts, of which six directly affect the corresponding senses in the living beings, each with its own particular characteristics. What does one understand by senses? Senses are to be understood as the realities through which the interaction between the energy of the living being and the energy of its surroundings can be elicited. And it is the reaction of this interaction that becomes the experience of life for the being in question. The kind of reactions and thereby the kind of experience of life to which the same being is subject will depend upon the kind of basic energies for which its senses are constructed. As to the six basic kinds of energy, there are six corresponding different forms of interaction between the living being's own energy and the energy of its surroundings, which must of necessity have as a consequence six different general forms for the experience of life. The individual does not experience these six general forms at the same time but, on the contrary, only one at a time. The living being has thus a period when its experience of life is prompted by the reactions from the first basic energy. When this promotion has culminated, its experience of life begins to be promoted by the reactions of the next energy and so on, until the sixth basic energy is reached. Then its experience of life begins to be promoted by the first basic energy again, but in a higher and more perfect form than the previous time, so that the individual constantly feels that he is moving towards higher and higher forms of existence. It is this movement we call evolution. Chapter 10, The Planes of Existence. As regards the six special basic energies, this evolution takes the form of a passage through six special sections, which means one for each basic energy. Each such section will thus represent a form of experience of life differing in essence from the experience of life of the other sections and is expressed by the term a plane of existence or kingdom. There are thus six planes of existence. Of these, the first constitutes what we call the plant kingdom, the second the animal kingdom and the third the human kingdom. The fourth I have given the name the kingdom of wisdom, the fifth the divine world, and the sixth the kingdom of bliss. Of these kingdoms, the terrestrial human being has passed the culmination of the animal kingdom and is well on his way to the next kingdom. He is still not a perfect human being, but he is not a pure animal either. He is a transitional being between animal and man. This is more easily understood when one recognizes which basic energies lie behind the kingdoms. People have not yet become acquainted with these basic energies in their true nature as energy but rather as realities that are expressed by the terms instinct, gravity, feeling, intelligence, intuition and memory. These realities thus constitute for cosmic clear-sightedness life's great and absolute basic energies. Everything in existence is made up of these energies. Behind the plant kingdom lies the energy of instinct. Behind the animal kingdom lies the energy of gravity. This latter energy is of such a nature that it promotes the killing principle or everything that comes under the term sorrow, ill health and mutilation. Behind the human kingdom lies the energy of feeling, or that energy that in its highest form appears as love.